Thanks for downloading this podcast from Twin Cities News Talk. If you'd like to have your advertising message heard on this podcast and reach an active, engaged, and dedicated audience, contact me, Andrew Lee, at iHeartMedia.com. Position your business in front of the most powerful audience in the entire Twin Cities. Andrew Lee at iHeartMedia.com. Now, please enjoy this podcast. Welcome and thanks for downloading another edition of the Minnesota Beercast. I'm Andrew Lee. You can hear me every morning on Up and Adam right here on Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, and joined, as usual, by my co-host and beer guru, Schmitty.
I don't know about guru.
I've decided to call you.
All right. I'll let you.
That's what I'm going with.
I'll allow it.
Another fun show on tap this week. Again, thanks for downloading. Thanks for checking out. And thanks for telling your friends about it, too. We've been getting a lot of good referrals, a lot of good reviews on iTunes and likes on our Facebook page. So we really appreciate you out there spreading the word and letting people know about the show. What do we got going on this week, Schmitty?
We're loaded for bear once again. We've got super lawyer extraordinaire Jeff O'Brien in the studio. And we've also joined by Kathy from Wolf Brewing, and we've got some folks calling in, so we're all set. We're good to go.
Should be a fun show. How's your week?
It's been a tough week. I'm battling a bit of a cold, and I've got a sick kid at home. So,
oh, that's worst.
Yeah,
it's more, you know, it's bad enough to be sick, but when you're sick and you got a sick kid, oh.
Yeah.
The combination is just brutal.
Yeah, it's been tough. I haven't had a chance to get much done, and the kid's been home from school, so yeah, it's been a challenge.
Good times. Well, then, glad you made it in to talk about beer for a little while.
Yeah, it's good to get away. So, let's get into it. Let's start with Jeff. Jeff, tell us a bit about yourself and your practice and how you get into this.
Well, I am an attorney with Lohman Abdo, which is a law firm downtown Minneapolis. And I have the good fortune, I think, to represent probably in all stages of life, I think, 2 to 3 dozen breweries, distilleries, even a winery. And just kind of happened to stumble into it about 5-6 years ago and just kept building the practice. And so get to have a lot of fun, a lot of different legal issues, mm-hmm. sometimes maddening, which we'll talk about some of that probably today, but have the privilege to represent a lot of very cool brewery clients, including Joseph Wolfe. And, you know, Kathy and her sister Pat have brought back and revived their great-grandfather's brewery, which it previously existed in Stillwater prior to Prohibition. So I thought we'll talk a little bit about some of the different legal issues that they face because they're doing contract brewing.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a fun practice area. A lot of attorneys in town want my job.
I want your job. I got a lot of
law school classmates that are very jealous of what I get to do on a daily basis. So
how do you make your way into that market space? How do you say, you know, I want to be the beverage attorney?
You know, it's funny. It just kind of happened. I was working, I've always worked with a lot of new businesses, and it just happened that we started working with a brewery as one of them, and it grew. And, you know, you do your marketing and everything, but really to be, my opinion, to really seriously hold yourself out as being a brewery lawyer, as opposed to just a lawyer that wants to work with breweries, you really have to immerse yourself in this stuff. And it's not just knowing the beers and what they're about and all that. It's not just about knowing the different laws and not just the how to form your business and how to do a trademark. And that you have to know there's some pretty serious liquor laws out there, state and federal.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you have to really understand the business of brewing beer. You get involved with all the trade groups, you know, you read all the books. I've read the Brewers Association Guide to Starting a Brewery. I love it when new clients come in and they have it in tow because I know what they've already been exposed to. So you just basically, you know, it's no different than representing, you know, if you were an attorney that represented a whole bunch of banks, you understand every facet of the banking industry.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you're going to be a brewery lawyer, you have to understand every facet of the brewing industry.
Nice. So how did you get your first brewery client? Did you luck into it?
Yes. Anyone who knows me knows that I tend to be kind of the Uber marketer. So I usually try to figure, you might get one one client and then figure out how do I build this into a mass scale and get mini clients. And so what happened was, this is actually at a previous law firm. Someone joined the firm, had a brewery in tow. Mm-hmm. I had to go jump in and help with a lot of different things. And, you know, we learned all this stuff. It's like, well, what do we do with it now? I said, well, we go get more. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and so it was, I think that was the year before the taproom law.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then I think you and I met during that whole thing mm-hmm. when I was blogging about it and tweeting about it and Facebooking about it. Mm-hmm. And the rest, as they say, is history. It just keeps, you know, just keep providing content. I just decided I was going to educate people on the issue, the legal issues surrounding breweries. And it seemed to be a marketplace for it. People seemed to come to me to want to talk about, to work with them.
It seems like breweries and distilleries and wineries would be a lawyer's kind of fantasy land. It's surrounded by laws and regulation.
Right? You know, the fun thing about it, Andy, is there are so many different legal angles to these businesses. You know, you don't just have business law with, you know, forming a, what type of entity should I form and should I have a buy sell agreement and all this kind of stuff. You have intellectual property, you have trademarks, and that's really hot. You know, we just saw this week, I think it was one of the Minnesota breweries, Bent Paddle, mm-hmm. settled a trademark dispute with a brewery on the East Coast. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very competitive right now. All these wineries starting, the naming is very important because the trademark office lumps everything together. And so I said, it's going to get to the point where we're going to have they're going to start naming breweries, brewery number 5,012, because they've run out of names to trademark, you know?
Well, and it gets to be, you know, you can only go back to the well so many times, right? Hoppy beer, you know, number one, hoppy beer,
right.
Number two, right?
Right, right. So, you know, so you get the trademark issues, you get security stuff, which of course that area of the law is changing.
Explain what that is.
Securities law is in order to, you know, all these, it costs money to start a brewery mm-hmm. and you're probably not going to get it all from a bank. A bank will say, we'll give you X amount, but you need to bring so much percent to the table. And because you have to be able to afford your equipment and have some ongoing operating expenses to, you know, to pay your lease payments. I mean, it's a tricky business to get into because you have to, in order to get a license, you have to show them a floor plan of your location, which implies that you have a location, which probably means you're paying a lease, but you can't make anything until you have a license. Mm-hmm. So you get tricky real estate issues. This morning I was working on some edits to a lease for a distillery client. You know, there's different things that happen you can't use a cookie cutter commercial lease mm-hmm. for a business that's producing liquor. Mm-hmm. And so we have to do some special, you know, tweaks and things to it as we go. You know, the security stuff is, you know, how you raise money. There's lots of different ways to do it. Everybody knows the term crowdfunding now. Mm-hmm. That's still a very young area of securities law. You know, you have exempt offerings. You have these rewards-based crowdfunding where people are giving away shirts and glasses in exchange for a little bit or a, you know, a pint a day, growler a week, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. All sorts of different angles, how you find, and in terms of how you find the money to finance these things to start them up.
Yeah. Yeah. What's your take on the crowdfunding to start a brewery business? I know it's been a popular mode to generate not only revenue, but also to generate some buzz, for lack of a better pun, around your...
It's a bit of early brand awareness.
Yeah.
You know, if it's done well and it's done right.
If that's your goal.
Right.
Right. And I don't know if there's a question if that should be your goal, right? I mean, to me, why are you using a resource that's supposed to be there for funding to create awareness for your brand? If you've already got enough money to start your brewery, why are you out, you know, using it to build awareness? You know, I mean, it seems a bit disingenuous.
Well, I think you have to be realistic about what, and we have to distinguish in when you hear the term crowdfunding, there's two different kinds of crowdfunding. There's the rewards-based crowdfunding we're talking about with the t-shirts and glasses and, you know, having special benefits to members, the founders clubs, those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. Then there's this new thing coming. It's really still in its infancy of equity-based crowdfunding. Mm-hmm. Okay. Because generally speaking, to raise money, you have to go to people that have money. You know, there's a definition of an accredited investor under the law, which is $1 million net worth, not including your home, mm-hmm. or $200,000 annual income if you're an individual, $300,000 joint, and an expectation that's going to continue. And that's where the disclosure requirements, and that's the least amount of legal headache you have to try to raise money. The hard part with the breweries is the people that want to give money to start to own part of a brewery are not those people.
Right.
You probably have thousands of people around just in this state alone that would throw in $500 to $1,000 to have a piece of a brewery, yeah. right? The laws haven't caught up to that.
Well, didn't some of that change recently, though?
Yes and no. There's now 587 pages of federal regulations as to how you legally do equity-based crowdfunding.
Bathroom reading.
Yes, exactly. I told my partner, I said, why don't they just put out one page that says, we don't want you doing this.
Right.
But the other piece is you also have to have a state exemption. And that's my understanding is there may be a bill coming into the Minnesota legislature this next session. Wisconsin passed something, I think, last year. And I've heard that there is something that may be in the works proposed in Minnesota this year to create this exemption. Because right now, if you raise money from 35 or more people who are not accredited, you have to register the offering with the state. You don't have an exemption available. So my understanding is they're going to propose creating an exemption that would track with if the feds are going to allow equity-based crowdfunding, then Minnesota would as well. And it's going to get into using these websites and who's vetting what. And it's again, probably have another, we may not get 500 pages of regulations. We may only get 200. I don't know.
Okay.
But it's a hard area because this is exactly why we have securities laws. You know, when we had the stock market crash in 1929 and the Great Depression and everything, and everybody was selling, you know, this weird stuff out in the marketplace, and people went bust. This is exactly why you have securities laws, and so you're turning a regime that's been around since the 30s on its head to raise money. And yeah. So we'll see. I'm skeptical as to how far the equity crowdfunding ever goes.
Yeah, it's an interesting tactic for sure.
Well, now you're starting to hear a lot of issues, too, with a lot of these companies that have used crowdfunding and offered rewards, and then they haven't delivered on the rewards, and it's starting to get real hairy in there. And it's so just, you know, be cautious and make sure that you're vetting what you're giving to before you start cutting checks to these places money.
The fine print in a lot of these agreements is that, you know, you're making more or less a donation and they're not obligated to give you anything, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You look at like Kickstarter. If you don't hit the number, they don't, you know, they don't fund.
Right.
You know, those kinds of things. You know, a lot of the clients I work with are doing these programs after they have raised all their money, after they have their bank loan, after they have their lease, after they filed with the TTB. Mm-hmm. And they're doing it, as you said, as a marketing program. Mm-hmm. Because you aren't going to raise $200,000 to $300,000 through a crowdfunding.
Sure. Yeah. How many growler memberships are you really going to sell?
Right. It's a great way to market, though, when you've got, you know, you've got a bunch of breweries opening up in neighborhoods. It's a great way to get interest in the community.
Right.
And get a steady stream of customers in the door.
Right. Well, I think we've got some callers on the line. Why don't we jump to that and then come back with Jeff and Kathy and get into some of the more specific challenges and obstacles that Kathy and the members of Joseph Wolf Brewing Company face when we come back.
All right. Joining us on the line right now is Tom Hill from Bemidji Brewing Company. Hey, Tom. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me again. Appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. So we wanted to have you on today to talk about your release coming up. Don't you tell us a little about it?
Yeah, so this will be our first bottle release. We've hand-bottled 500 bottles of our double porter, which is our winter warmer. So it'll be available only in the tap room starting tomorrow. And we're just pretty excited about our first bottle offering and kind of something that will be able to be cellared and kind of sat on for a little while or just enjoyed right now.
That's exciting for you guys. It's the first time you've actually bottled something. Why the change? What's different about this beer than previous?
Sure. So I guess In the past, we've done only growlers as far as any off-sale or anything you could take home with you. That works fantastic for most beers that we do. But with the double porter, it's something that's a little bit higher alcohol. It could certainly, you know, benefit from some aging, and it's something where we kind of want people to be able to use it as a celebratory experience, be able to open at a special dinner, and not so much be confined by the fallbacks of the growler, which are really only a few weeks of shelf life.
Mm-hmm.
So by counter pressure filling and purging the bottles and everything, it's got a much more stable shelf life, able to be cellared, something that you can pick up a few bottles of, open one now, and then sit on it and kind of explore as it changes and ages.
So is this caged and corked, or how is this packaged and sealed?
This is 750. It's crown capped, not caged and corked.
Okay.
And it is not bottle conditioned, so there won't be any sediment on the bottom. It's all carbonated. It's ready to go as it sits right now.
Nice. So winter warmer, it's kind of an ambiguous term, right?
It is.
explain what that means.
And that's something new that we're kind of rolling out this year is last year we had a double porter as well, and it's different than this beer. We kind of wanted to evolve it, and we didn't want to be tied down to one specific beer that comes back in the same format or the same form every year.
Mm-hmm.
We want to kind of be able to evolve that program.
Mm-hmm.
So by calling it a winter warmer, placing a date on it, a vintage on it, we're able to hopefully move forward and kind of evolve it throughout the years. This one happens to be a double porter. It's a different take than last year. Last year we dry hopped it and kind of was almost a crossing of black IPA and a big porter, where this year it's all about the malt. It's a little more decadent. It's definitely a malty, chocolatey, dark fruit forward beer.
Nice. What is it?
The winter warmer is more of alluding to, the fact that it's something you can just kind of sip and enjoy, hopefully by a fireplace in the winter.
Warm you from the insides.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's 8.5% alcohol, so it's not through the roof, but it's enough to certainly warm you up.
Yeah, something that I know generally when I think about, aging beer and rule of thumb, I kind of go by about the 8%, if it's something I want to think about, cellaring, it's something that's less hoppy, mm-hmm. and something that I think might do well with a little bit of oxidation and is above 8%.
Something so. That'll
Absolutely.
Get happy over time.
A dark beer, it has a greater propensity to just age with the antioxidant characteristics of darker malt. Kind of work towards that, as well as just being something that's not bottle conditioned. So you've got less breakdown of any yeast material and sediment in the bottle. So we're hoping it's something that they'll be able to cellar for at least a couple years.
Nice. So what can you tell us about the beer? You say it's chocolate, dark fruit. What sets this porter apart from a stout?
Ah, sure. So with this one, there's no roasted barley in our porter, in our standard porter or the double porter. So with porters, I tend to focus more on the cocoa and chocolate and dark fruit character of the dark malts,
mm-hmm.
As long as a bit more caramel malt than, say, a lot of stouts might contain. So really, this one is, especially this year's order from caramel malts. So it doesn't have a huge roast bite to it. It's
okay.
Got some coffee character, but not in the... in the real dark roast, any sort of acrid roast character. So it's really much more of that chocolatey, smooth, decadent beer.
Nice.
Yeah.
If you were to pair this beer, what would you pair it with?
Oh, that's a great question. Strong cheeses are great with a dark beer, but really I think this one would just shine with, chocolate or fruit-based desserts as well.
Nice.
Or a cigar, that might be a great option with it as well.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of cigars and porters. They go extremely well together.
They certainly carry some same characteristics, so can't go wrong there.
Yeah, I went to the liquor store the other day, one of my favorite liquor stores, and I happened to be walking out, and I parked further away than I usually do, and I discovered that three doors down from one of my favorite liquor stores is a really great cigar shop. And I'm like, oh, no.
You can't beat that.
I'm like, nah, I'm in trouble because I'm going to be buying cigars way more often than I usually do. So, well, if folks want to get their hands on this latest double porter from Bemidji Brewing, Tom, where and when can they get it?
Yeah, it's available starting tomorrow at 2 p.m. when our tap room opens. And like I said, we have 500 bottles of it. We've already got people attempting to request it and that to try and hold some. So it's available only in the tap room. And when it's gone, it's gone. So we don't plan on cellaring any bottles in the brewery for later release. So we'll sell them all off
wow.
as soon as we can.
Are you going to have any on tap for folks to come in and grab a glass of it while they you know, sit with their bottles to take them home, or is it going to be just
great
bottles
question.
Only?
Yeah, and that's a good point. We will have the same beer on draft as well, so it'll be
great.
That release at the same time. So you'll be able to taste the same beer, the same vintage, determine if it's something you want to pick up a couple bottles of or maybe just buy the one. But we will have it on tap to compare, as well as coming up after the New Year's here, once you kind of get through the holidays, you can look forward to, we've sat on some of our 2013 double porters, so we'll be having a couple side-by-sides of the last of the current year and the previous year to be able to enjoy side-by-side as well.
And tell people where your brewery, where your tap room is located, and your website, so people can look you up.
Yeah, right on. It's right downtown Bemidji, 401 Beltrami, just a block up and a block in downtown from Paul and Babe. And we're open tomorrow from 2 p.m. to 11 p.m. So we'll be here having a good time, and the double porter will be available. And our website is BemidjiBeer.com, and it's the same on Facebook. And Facebook's probably the best option to find up-to-date events and news and releases and all that good stuff.
Cool. We'll be sure to put the link up on our show notes page. And for those that may be listening at a future date, tomorrow is actually Saturday the 13th, since this is a podcast and people might be listening a few days from now.
Cool. Well, thanks for calling in, Tom. I appreciate it. Keep us up to date with any more developments up in the North Country.
Appreciate it. Cheers.
All right. Thanks. Cool. Up next, we've got Excelsior Brewing on the line. How you doing?
Good. How about you?
Not too bad. Not too bad. So you're calling in to tell us a little bit about what you guys have going on at the brewery.
Yeah, no. Jennifer told me that you guys were willing to chat with us. And she mentioned to bring up the glue vine, which we made. We kind of made a beer inspired from a glue vine.
Yeah. I shared a link on Facebook this morning, and Jennifer said you guys had something going on, and I should come in and taste it. And said, I just don't have the time, but I want to hear about it, and I want to talk about it. So tell us a little bit about the glue vine beer.
Yeah, you know, it's an amber-colored beer. It's a spice beer. No hops. We use no hops in the beer. But, you know, put a lot of spices into it. You know, typically a glue wine is the cinnamon, clove, and maybe some orange, you know, the actual traditional wine. But we used a lot of orange peel, put some coriander, lemongrass, juniper berry, cinnamon, clove, rosehip, and some chamomile.
So how close would you say you've come to replicating the taste and aroma of a genuine glue wine?
You know, I think there would be probably a big difference. Our beer ended up kind of, you know, there's a lot going on, but you really, with the aroma of it, you're getting a lot of that lemongrass and coriander aroma.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the body's light. You know, it's kind of hard to actually try to go for the real thing because it's just a whole different base. You know, you're trying to make a beer into a wine, so. You know, it turned out as a really nice beer. It's a really sessionable beer. Very nice spice to it, and with the no hops, it kind of has a nice little sweetness to it too.
So, are you guys serving it warm? How is it? How is it being served?
We have not. No, originally that was the plan. We did kind of mess with some smaller volumes of it, warming it up, and we figured it'd be better if we served it cold.
You guys are getting adventurous out at Excelsior Brewing. I saw the week before this, you guys were doing stuff with milfoil and all kinds of crazy stuff.
Yeah. we have a 3.5-barrel pilot system that we started running in July, so it's quite fun. We get to make a beer about a week on it, and we get to And we did a beer with milfoil and zebra mussels in it, and we got a lot of hype about it. And it was a saison. It was a strong saison. It was at 8.2%, but it was a fun beer. It sold fast, and I don't know if we'll be doing it in the future, but we'll definitely look into it.
It sounds interesting. I know some of my geekier beer friends were a bit dismissive of the zebra mussel and milfoil beer with, you know, it's just a gimmick. I think gimmicks are fun, though, you know.
Yeah, well, why not do a gimmick every once in a while? There's nothing wrong with that.
Right, and it really, you know what, it brought a lot of awareness to the whole situation. So
we'll talk about what the situation is.
It was kind of a chuckle between Bob and I. It's like, yeah, you know, what originally happened is we did it for Grumpy's in Northeast. They had an event where we had to make beer with wild rice and hops that they grew. And then we had to add a native Minnesota ingredient. So we thought it would be funny, being that we are lake oriented and we are on Lake Minnetonka, which is infested with both. We thought it would be fun to actually put it into the beer and get awareness out of it. And that really was successful. I mean, we get calls from out of state DNRs, it seems like every day, you know, wanting to get this beer and talking about how great it is for the awareness.
Is there plans to make production volume of the beer if it got that large response?
You know, it's all in the talk right now. So, you know, there are no immediate plans to do it, but we might revisit it, you know, maybe late next summer is kind of what we're thinking. You know, it was a hit, but we don't know if we're ready to take it to the 20-barrel scale yet, but we're talking maybe fall, maybe come on with it.
Nice. I think that's I think that's adventurous and interesting. And
yeah.
And did you guys donate any of the funds towards, you know, the causes at the lake?
Definitely. If we were to go that route, definitely we would, actually a dollar from all of our beers sold go into the lake. So we would definitely put back to the lake.
Nice.
No doubt, you know?
Excellent. That's good to know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you guys also have some other fun stuff coming up the brewery. You've got an Arctic Fat Fever fat bike race, right?
Yeah, the fat tire race. Yep.
Yeah, that's a lot of F's and to say at once without messing it up. Tell us,
totally.
Tell us.
That's
how
a
that,
risky
right?
name.
Well, I figure we're not actually over the airwaves, right. So I'd chance it. What's tell us about that?
Yeah, no, it's a blast. You know, this will be the third year of doing it. The first 2 years were the first year where there was no snow with 50-mile-an-hour winds. So it's just a nightmare for the riders. Last year we had too much snow. So it's always interesting. It's a good time at the actual tap house. You know, we have live music going all day. We have right now on tap, we have 12 different varieties of beer to go. So, I mean, it's just a blast to come out, see the music, watch the bike race. It's always funny. These guys go on the lake, over land. I mean, they're all over the place. So it's a lot of humor. I'm usually a spectator watching.
Yeah, it looks like it's up to 200 participants for $5. They can enter in their 3-inch tire wide bikes and go for a 15-mile race. And then afterwards, they get to
and it's open
some beer
to anybody, and they can register either on our webpage, excelsiorbrew.com, or they can do it through Eric's Bike Shop too.
Cool. Yeah, looks like a party. Nothing better than just embracing the cold and getting out there.
That's right. You got to do it, right?
Yeah, you can see that, or you just sit inside and suffer, right?
Yeah, you got to keep yourself busy. That's the beauty of Minnesota winter.
Exactly. Cool. Well, awesome. Yeah. Well, thanks for calling in. If people want to check out those links, we'll have them in the show notes. Otherwise, check out the racing notes at the Eric's Bike Shop or at excelsiorbrew.com.
Perfect.
All right, thanks brother.
For calling in, man.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Bye.
All right, back to the law.
Beer law. It's kind of like bird law, but it's a little different.
All right. So let's.
Somebody got that joke out there.
Probably the lawyer.
I got it.
So let's talk about how the law applies to your situation in particular, Kathy, and Wolf Brewing, and what kind of stuff you guys have to navigate around as a contract brewery, and explain for those listening what it means to be a contract brewery.
Sure, absolutely. So, you know, our family hasn't had a easy time with the law. We actually got shut down by Prohibition, which was the start of all of this. So we're extremely happy that some of the laws are starting to be repealed. There's a lot of room for more movement. But,
yes, there is.
You know, for us, the idea and the concept of reopening and reinvigorate invigorating the Joseph Wolf brand was really around how best to go to market. And so while we looked at all the plausible ways, as Jeff mentioned, you know, kind of trying to find a piece of property and going to market is a challenge. So we opted to go down a different route, which was really associate ourselves with somebody who is a commercial brewer, somebody who understood the business and could actually make solid beer for us, and then we would take it to market and make sure that we knew a lot of the various pieces that went along with it. So we did it what we call more of a soft launch. We were most interested in making sure that we knew the various pieces that were there, not only from the law side, but from the business side. And so contract brewing was a really great fit for us. We before we met up with our current brewer, we actually were investigating different brewers for contract brewing for probably about 2 years and ended up actually landing with this particular brewer. And so it's a little bit of a process of understanding your business and more your model that you want to take to market and your growth plans, and then determining what's most important to you. My sister and I are not home brewers, and we don't try to pretend that we are. The value that we bring to the business is both of us have been multi-business owners in the past. This is her fourth business and my third business. So really, we were looking at ways to fill that void, and contract brewing was the best way.
Sure, and you guys have the family ties and the history to be able to bring that brand to the business, right?
Well, and that was really the main reason I don't think her and I would ever really go about making beer if that wasn't it, right? So, you know, the original brewery founded in 1868 was, there was a lot of brand awareness still in the Stillwater and St. Croix Valley area. So there's a lot of people who still want to know where the Wolf Brewery is. They don't, you know, they want to go try the beer. And so we've heard that for years and years and years. And so this has been a family goal for about 15 years to actually start this back up.
So is the ultimate goal to have the Joseph Wolf Brewery back and operating in Stillwater, or is it going to be enough to be content contract brewing for the long term or short term, or how are things laid out for the future?
Well, again, a lot of it depends on the laws that are out there. We're hoping some of them change. But the ultimate goal is to absolutely have a physical location in Stillwater where people can find Wolf Brewery, actually experience it and understand a little bit of the brand. And we would love nothing more than to be in the original location, which is the caves that are in downtown Stillwater. At this particular time, that isn't aligning really well, but we're of the mindset that at some point in time, we hope that will be the case. Outside of that, we will be in Stillwater for sure.
And so where is your beer brewed right now?
So when we started this process in contract brewing, our brewer was located in Stillwater. And so we started brewing with him. Since then, he actually got married, had a baby, and his wife is from Duluth. And so they relocated to Duluth and packed up the equipment and moved up there. So they are brewing for us up in Duluth.
Okay.
Okay.
So what kind of challenges does that create as somebody who's not in Duluth but having your beer made up there?
Well, I think any relationship really comes down to trust and confidence that you've selected the right partner to do business with. And we had the ability to understand and work with this person prior to that move, so that was really helpful. I think prior to that, you just have to do your due diligence like you would in any kind of business offering, is make sure that you really know what and who you're getting into business with or entering a relationship with. Contractually, you have the right agreements in place, and you set expectations in terms of what you expect and what they expect in return.
Now, Jeff, maybe you can speak a little bit to what some of those right agreements in place would be. What do you think it takes for those agreements to be on behalf of a contract brewer?
Sure. Well, one of the obviously the key agreement is the contract brewing agreement. You know, they're always a little bit different. Now, you know, Joseph Wolf is one of a handful of contract brewing clients that our firm represents. The other ones is the Hanson brothers out of, you know, the band Hanson from the 1990s. They are into craft beer now, so they have the same thing. Each relationship is a little bit different in terms of who's controlling distribution, whereas, you know, here Kathy and Pat have a wholesaler's license. They're in the eyes of the law, they look like a distributor. You know, they have the ability to distribute just like some of the, you know, the distributors around here would do. But it's kind of weird. It's like, but it's a brewery, though. So it's a little bit of a weird legal creature in terms of how they, in terms of their licensing and their authority to be able to sell their own product. in other cases, you know, the contract brewery may handle distribution for that. For, you know, as like a private label type thing. Everybody's familiar with the Third Street Brew House up in Cold Spring. Cold Spring, before they were, when they were known as Cold Spring Brewing, they do a lot of contract brewing up mm-hmm. there besides doing the Third Street label. So Minnesota's always had a lot of contract brewing, but yeah, you have to have a good agreement. And the other thing too is you really, you know, we talk back to talking about intellectual property. You really have to lock down all your trademarks and everything, and you're giving over your brand, your recipes to somebody else to make.
Yeah.
You know, because it's the contract brewery that does all the reporting to the feds, that pays the excise taxes and everything. You're giving them your business is in their hands. You don't want to have a situation where you end up maybe going with a different contract brewery at some point, or eventually going off and doing your own, you know, production brewery, and then find out that whoever you had done a contract with now is making a surprisingly similar beer. That is a risk,
right?
Yeah. You know,
and people trademark their recipes.
They can't trademark recipes, but it's trade secrets law. It's a, you know, if you consider the recipes proprietary and you put that into the contract brewing agreement, just like you would with any other brewery having an employment agreement with their master brewer, that any recipes are proprietary and belong to the brewery. So you have to specify that those formulas, those recipes, everything is proprietary. So it's more in a trade secret law than trademark law gotcha. When it comes to the recipes themselves.
I mean, there is a real long history, and I would almost say tradition of contract brewing in Minnesota. I mean, you'd look at you know, Shell's, mm-hmm. they did contract brewing for the longest time. You mentioned Cold Spring, lots of contract brewing there. It still does. You know, you've got Fulton, who just now, you know, within the last, I don't know how many months, opened up their new facility in Minneapolis, but they were contract brewing for a long time.
And I think they still are doing some contract brewing.
Could very well be. Mm-hmm. I know I wouldn't want to just flip on that switch. I would certainly operate it like a dimmer, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So,
right.
I mean, there's a lot of contract brewing that happens.
Well, there's business reasons for doing it. We talked about before about how costly it is to start a brewery. For some people, that's the motivation to do contract brewing, or doing the alternating proprietorship that, of course, everybody's familiar with. At one point, it was Lucid and Badweather and Badger Hill, and that ended up, now you see Badweather and Badger Hill have moved on and graduated to having their own spaces, you know. So, you know, it's there's a lot of different ways you can go about getting to market with your beer. In this case, Kathy and Pat have, it's almost a geographic issue. You know, ideally, there is a building in downtown Stillwater near the caves called the Joseph Wolf Building. Ideally, that would be where we would want to be, yeah. But it's, you know, there's for various reasons that it hasn't worked out.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's some, you have the option of sitting here. Kathy mentioned that it's been a 15-year dream. Well, you can sit here and spin your wheels and keep pursuing the dream, or you can do plan B, put the, you know, go to market under a contract relationship, build the brand back up, build the beers back up, and then when all of a sudden all the pieces of the puzzle will fall into place.
Well, it's like anything else, right? Do you want to wait for everything to align, or you just want to get moving?
Mm-hmm. Right? Exactly, and that's kind of the stake in the ground we did. It's like,
yeah.
Let's move.
Right. Well, and then you get back to the same thing with our other contract brewing client here, and I've got, I think, might be the only two bottles of hops that are in the state right now. They obviously have a very high-profile day job. They love craft beer.
I'm so tempted to sing right now. I'm not going to do it, but I'm so tempted.
As soon as you say the name of the beer, the song is in your head, you know,
and it won't leave for a long time.
But they, you know, they are big into craft beer. They want to eventually do a production brewery, mm-hmm. but they have a high profile day job that keeps them occupied. So the next best thing was and they're coming into this new. They know they like beer, right? But they don't know they weren't familiar with the business behind it. So hey, let's work with somebody, let's partner with somebody, and let's get to that point. So that again, it's a starting point for some people. Other than just, I'm going to raise money, I'm going to get space, I'm going to file, get my license, and I'm going to go.
I think the difference between the Hansen boys and a lot of other folks is they have the capital to start a brewery probably if they want to. They've been making money for a long time. Now, they probably don't know all the business side of it, and I think that's great that they start doing contract stuff and probably learn those ropes a little bit. But you talked about the, you know, the raising the capital, all those agreements you have to have in place. It's a really cash-intensive operation to start a brewery.
It is. It is.
Yeah.
Is that why? I mean, is it all set up because of the existing structures to keep as much competition out as possible? What is your take on why it's so intense?
I think it's intensive because just the cost of doing it. You have equipment, you have ingredients, you have to lease space, so you have operating expenses. You know, in some respects, yes, I think that the legal structure that's there does add to the cost. It's going to be significant no matter what. Mm-hmm. But if we jump into the distribution law, if you have to, you know, you have the right in Minnesota to self-distribute up to 20,000 barrels, mm-hmm. okay? Most breweries are going to do that, are going to self-distribute up to that point because of what the consequences are. Once you sign on with somebody, it's essentially a marriage for, you know, it's there, it's marriage, it's life, right? That costs money. You know, if you have to go have people, you know, driving the trucks, you know, all that kind of stuff, it isn't cheap to, you know, it's time intensive. You know, mm-hmm. Kathy and Pat have to go and make the contacts with, even as a contract brewery, have to go make contacts with the different liquor stores and bars and whatnot, and, you know, and get those relationships started and get their beers on tap or get their bottles on the shelves. That just takes effort away from, you know, that just takes more personnel and more bodies to make it grow. You know, if someone wants to say, well, I just want to, even if I'm not up to the 20,000 barrels, I want to have somebody else do this. Well, now we get into the franchise laws and you've got a situation where you may end up, you don't get to sample distributors.
Oh, well, why not?
In Minnesota, and I really think that we probably have the absolute worst beer distribution law of any state in the union. You can have you can form a distribution arrangement, mm-hmm. distribution contract, without having a written agreement. So if a distributor came into your tap room and said, "Give me a keg, let me take it to some of the liquor stores and see if it works. If it goes, I'll let you know how it goes. Congratulations, you have your distributor."
Wow.
And you have no and the statute lays out. It says only, you know, it's 90 days notice and an opportunity to cure, and it's only termination for cause. And the statute defines cause, and it says regardless of what your contract says, this is cause.
The statute defines cause?
The statute defines cause, and there's some magic language.
In what other industry would a statute get into contract law like that?
Yeah, I've
never heard of that.
It's the most frustrating aspect of working with these breweries is dealing with the distribution law. You know, so what you there's really any brewery that's thinking about working with a distributor, you have to consult an attorney, whether it be your existing. It has to be somebody that knows that law, and there's not many of us in town that know that law. And you have to, in order to make sure that you have the ability to have, you know, some say so over quality control and all those kinds of things, you have to have it worded certain magic language to trigger it into the verbiage of the statute to be able to have even that. I mean, that only gives you the right to give them notice and the chance to cure it within 90 days. Huh.
So if I enter into an agreement with I'm Brewery A and I enter into distribution agreement with Brewery B and I'm not happy with the service I'm getting from Brewery A to Distributor B and I'm not happy with the service they're giving me, what are my options at that point? My hands are tied, or how does it work?
You can give them notice of what you claim is the grounds for termination,
mm-hmm.
And give them 90 days to cure it. They could come back with their attorney, who they probably will, and say it does not meet the definition of cause. It's not an issue, and if you do anything, if you try to do anything, we'll sue you, or you can pay, you know, X amount, and we'll let, you know, some exorbitant amount, and we'll let you out of your contract.
Did a distributor write this law?
You know, it's interesting. It's interesting that you bring that up. And Andy, you forwarded me this week. There's a story in the New York Times from Sunday,
mm-hmm.
An opinion piece by Steve Hindy, who's the founder of Brooklyn Brewing.
Yeah, kind of a hero of mine.
Yeah, and Steve was actually in town at Fulton this summer as part of their week-long tour through the cities, and I got a chance to meet him and listen to him talk on their – they had a panel up there with Fulton and Urban Growler and Shells, and Steve was on there. And Steve brings up a point about consolidation amongst distributors, and this is the same point. And Kathy and I were at a Business Journal program about – was it a month ago?
A little more than a month ago.
And Mark Stutrud said the same thing. Mark Stutrud from Summit said the same thing, that he's very concerned at the consolidation taking place on the distribution side, because the reason the Minnesota Beer Distribution Statute was enacted in 1977. It came at the end of a time where all of the breweries had consolidated. So you had a handful of big breweries and a lot of small distributors. And, mm-hmm. and it was a fight over those breweries' brands. And so the reason the statute is worded the way it is was to give somewhat of a level playing field for the distributors who were battling big breweries.
Sure. At that point in time, it was the breweries playing the distributors off of each other.
Right, right. Now,
roles are reversed.
The roles are reversed, but the thing is, the legislatures don't wake up and say, "Oh, well, now the roles are reversed in this whole liquor thing. We'll change the law back." But no, because the distributors and their lobbyists are in there with big checks every election cycle,
mm-hmm.
Or big checks for their opponents if they vote against it. So I was at a thing. The Minnesota Brewing Association did a little legislative panel up at Fulton this past spring, and Joe Adkins was there. He was then the chair of the mm-hmm. of the Commerce Committee, who handles the liquor bills. My assumption is in the new session he'll probably be the ranking member, the ranking Democrat.
Yeah, I would think.
The breweries gave them a list of, and this is the lobbying group for the packaging breweries, and there was a whole number of issues that they had raised as things that they wanted to see addressed. And when this came up about the franchise laws, he didn't even want to hear it.
Wow,
didn't even want to hear it. Said it's, and it's not that he's necessarily opposed to it. He said it's a non-starter.
Well, how is it a non-starter? I think right now
he's pointing out this. You know, money is the mother's milk of politics. There's a lot of people up there that are getting checks every cycle from the lobbying arm for the distributors to keep that law in place. You know, if you look at other states, a lot of states have beer franchise laws.
Mm.
They aren't the same as Minnesota's. Some of them have exemptions for small brewers. And there's an argument to be made that there's a difference between, you know, someone who's just starting out and someone who's, you know, maybe doing a couple hundred thousand barrels.
Sure. So what's to stop, a distributor who owns the rights to large macro brewery ABC and buys up the, you know, makes an agreement with small Minnesota brewery, you know, DEF, and decides that, you know, the large brewery who's doing way more volume is clearly their priority and does a disservice to small brewery DEF, who has no recourse. I mean, there's really not much you can do.
No, there's not. And that's why I try to educate. That's why I talked when I'm talking with new brewery clients at the outset. Why would I be talking about distribution to a brand new brewery that's just working on their business plan because of this issue?
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't, you know, and, you know, you've seen in recent years, the workaround is that the breweries self-distribute up to the maximum point, 20,000 barrels, and then they sell their distribution rights.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that gets into the other issue we've had this week is down in Texas, we had a lawsuit where the court found there's three Texas craft brewers that have sued the state over a change to their distribution law, which prohibited breweries from selling their distribution rights.
Yeah, they've got some wacky stuff in Texas. There's a really great group down there, a consumer group called Open the Taps. If you guys are in Texas, check them out. But so tell us about the Texas change or the lawsuit that I guess resulted as a change that happened last year.
Well, the change was that they changed the law to prohibit breweries from selling exclusive distributor rights, which is what distribution agreements are. When you enter into a distribution agreement with somebody for a particular territory, mm-hmm. you are making them the exclusive distributor in that territory. And like I said, what has been happening in recent years was that breweries were making distributors pay for those distribution, those exclusive distribution rights. Mm-hmm. You know, they'd build up the brand themselves. They'd spend the money, self-distribute, get the brand hot, and then
sell it off.
Yeah. And some of the local breweries have done that as well.
It sounds like the way you described it, if you're a relatively new brewer and you're not completely familiar with how the law works, that you could unknowingly enter into a distribution agreement.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And there's no recourse for you, for the brewer on that. So a unsavory distributor could take advantage of or attempt to take advantage of a new brewer.
That would never happen. Yeah.
No.
Well, the bigger problem is this: when we get back to the consolidation issue that Mr. Hindy and Mr. Stutru have raised, is the Minnesota statute basically drags all the breweries along when the distributor sells out to somebody else. What we had in this state smaller distributors that were, I would say, probably craft friendly. There were a number of craft breweries going with particular distributors. They sold out to bigger distributors, the ones that are going to just throw them in the corner and focus more on what, you know, the bigger, the macro brands, as mm-hmm. you call them. And there's no way for a brewery out of their distribution agreement because of the sale. They can't, and there's very narrow grounds to, you have to somehow prove that you are somehow adversely affected, and it's a hard thing to prove. The only cases on this statute all, of course, involve Miller and Budweiser.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously, of course, every decision that's come down on this statute is all pro distributor. So, but, you know, we use an example, we talk about the Hansons here. When I said about these are the only two bottles in the state, you know, these were given to us because of, you know, being their attorneys, and we had to use them and stuff. But, you know, they use a national broker that pulled out of Minnesota in August of 2013 and has to sit out for 2 years in order to break their deal with the distributor that they were using here.
Is that the law? How does it break down? If you want to break into an agreement with your distributor, how does that all happen?
In this case, when you have an agent involved, okay, this is someone that this is Shelton Brothers, which is a wholesaler importer, mm-hmm. okay, but they also can serve as they might have relationships with distributors throughout the country.
Sure,
okay, they have to basically just not sell in Minnesota for 2 years. As an outside, you know, as someone bringing in as an importer,
mm-hmm.
before they can sign up with somebody else. If you're here and you sign up with somebody, good luck. You're there. You go out of business. That's the way you would bring back the beers under different names. That's how you would get out of your distribution law.
And that's all written in the statute that if you break your agreement, you have to leave the playground for 2 years before you can come
back.
Well,
this is that's different from the. I'm not exactly sure where the whole 2 year thing came from. It's. In terms of the outside beers mm-hmm. coming back in as like an export thing, that might even be in I don't know if it's necessarily in the statute itself. That pertains more to the relationship between the manufacturers and the wholesalers in the statute. I just know of the fact that that's what it is. It's 2 years they have to sit out. So this beer will probably be available in Minnesota end of next summer.
Are they planning on coming to Minnesota?
Yes.
Nice. Nice.
Excellent. We'll have to get them on the beer cast.
We'll have them bring the guitars in here.
Quick question about contract brewing. Is there a significant decrease in the risk if you go the contract brewing route, if you're you know, somewhat new and trying to start up, say, a new brand?
I don't know that risk in terms of you may not have as much invested.
I guess a better way to phrase the question would be is this a route to get a brand off the ground with less investment?
I would say yes. The risk is, and is that you have somebody else making your beer.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get to have the oversight in some respects over the product. Kathy, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that might be one of the, it's not necessarily a financial risk. It's a product quality control risk.
And that coupled with, if you do decide to move on to a different contract brewer, the quality of the beer with the next one. So
right.
Keeping it stable amongst your contract brewing is a really tough challenge.
How much how much input do you have in the recipe when, like, if in your example, for example, do you work with this brewer and say, here's sort of the idea that we have, here's what we're going for, here's some of the flavor profiles that I'd like, and you do some sampling? And
absolutely. And I think it kind of comes back to what Jeff mentioned earlier, is however way you want to structure that relationship, you can have. Our brewer is very much open to having those conversations, participating, allowing our input, our feedback. We do rely really heavily on his expertise, though. Most important is we want to stay true and focused on the brand that we're bringing to market and how it best fits with the previous Joseph Wolf brand.
Why don't you talk about that brand a little bit? Tell us about how Joseph Wolf came to be in Minnesota and what happened to the brand and how you guys started it back up.
Sure, absolutely. So my great-grandfather, along with his entire family, migrated from Switzerland. And so in Europe, it was very common that they brewed beer in the way that they decided to brew it here when they formed the brewery. So him and his brother, Martin, founded the brewery in Stillwater and elected to carve out the cave. So they found the appropriate space, because what's great about a cave is there's usually typically natural water, spring water, and then natural refrigeration.
What year was that?
That was in, 1868 was when they founded the brewery.
Okay.
It went through a couple of iterations, one of them being buyouts and fires and all the typical kind of stuff that happens in those kind of structures back then. But most importantly is I think they were really kind of leading the pack in terms of some of the things that they were doing, one of them being the size of the brewery and the amount of beer that they shipped, not only locally but regionally. They were one of the largest regional brewers out there. But they also implemented the first steam-driven powered brewery. So they were trying to a little bit of a leading edge on some of the things that they were doing. And one of the challenges between the two brothers was that it took 8 years to hand carve the caves. And so Martin didn't really want to wait. And so Joseph bought him out. And so Joseph ended up having the brewery on his own and a couple of other business partners along the way. But unfortunately, in 1921, the year after Prohibition, our great-grandfather at the age of 89 passed away. And while he really had the passion for it, they tried bottling water and making soda, and it really wasn't very effective. And the rest of the family didn't necessarily carry the same passion. And so all of the assets were really sold at that point, along with the structure. And so I would say, about that 15-year time frame ago, my sister Pat was really trying to get the four siblings to kind of rally behind and start this up. And unfortunately, we just weren't in the right position at that time. But she was smart enough to go ahead and actually trademark and re-trademark the name. And so we secured that piece of it. So our original logo, or the logo that we have today, is the original logo. Went through a little bit of a rendition change way back before we ever had it. But our goal is to really create more of the old-time brewery and the really the feeling of what it was like pre-Prohibition and carry that through.
Is there any plans to, I guess, recreate any of the beer recipes to do any historic brewing to try to bring the brand back alive? Or are you really looking forward to making it a more modern brand?
I think both. Definitely see if there is a palate out there for the original recipe. We're not sure there is.
But we
definitely want to try it, even if it's a small batch, just to see. And if nothing else, the beers will be very similar to the style that they were back then.
And you guys also have a beer cycle down in Stillwater too, right?
We do. We thought kind of one of the ways to let people know and create awareness was to purchase a multi-person pedal pub type scenario. And so we were able to get the laws changed in Stillwater to allow us to license a motor vehicle to allow alcohol on that. So we don't sell it. We actually just pour it so people bring it on. But it is sponsored by the Joseph Wolf Brewing Company. And so our goal is really just to have a lot of fun. Our great-grandfather was really big in the community and giving back. And so this was a way for us to couple both, create some awareness while giving back to the community.
Nice. You guys need to get that brewery building so you can have this just churn in and out of the brewery and tweeling around town. I think that's really cool.
Yep.
So if folks want to find out more about the brewery and the brand and Joseph Wolf Brewing, where can they go?
Absolutely. So josephwolfbrewing.com, or same thing on Facebook. We're Wolf Brew on Twitter as well.
Awesome. And Jeff, for your information, where can folks head to on the internet?
Google me. They'll find me. No. Lohmann.com is the firm's website. But yeah, I'm on Twitter at Jeff O'Brien, Facebook, LinkedIn. I don't know how many. What's the name of the new site? JeffreyO'Brien.today. Is that the new one?
Yeah. That's so the new website.
Got a few places you can find me.
Excellent. Cool. Well, thanks for coming in, and appreciate you guys coming on the BeerCast.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Great information. Really fascinating perspective. Thank you so much.
And if folks want to hit the Facebook page, we've got the contest still going on with the guys from Chopped Liver that are giving away those rare Beer Fest tickets.
Oh, fantastic.
So go tag yourself on that photo and keep up with everything that's going on. I'm at MN Schmitty on Twitter.
I'm at Andrew Lee, TCNT. Give us a follow. Let us know what you think. Give us some feedback on the show. And make sure you keep us up to date on anything that you might have going on, any events you might be aware of. Hit us up on Twitter or go to the BeerCast Facebook page and make a post and let us know.
See you.